welcome to another installment of the SUS News podcast series, where we interview experts and discuss the issues and news relevant to the global unmanned technologies community. I'm your program host, Patrick Egan, and as always, let's say a big hello and welcome to our co-host, Gene Robinson.
Hello, Patrick. How are you today? Things are well here in frigid Texas.
You're always, I like we get the weather update over there. Okay. Well, this week's episode number 31 is basically we're going to talk about the early days of SOCOM integration of small unmanned aircraft systems with our guest, small unmanned aircraft system entrepreneur and former Navy SEAL John Sermont. There's a boatload of material to go over here, so we're going to go long on this show. We're going an hour. But before we get into it with our guest, I want to talk about what Gene was doing last week. Gene, we missed you here on the program. What were you doing last week?
We were testing sensors, and more sensors. We've been working pretty hard trying to identify actual fire and flames from the air. And most people don't know. They think, sure, that's easy. Let's go for a FLIR camera and, you know, we're done. But most people don't know that a FLIR tau or a photon will actually saturate at 160 degrees because they've been calibrated to look for humans at 100 degrees. So, you know, when you point them at a fire or you point them at the hood of a black pickup truck here in Texas in August, you get the same signature. So we've been experimenting with putting neutral density filters in front of our TASE Duo lenses, and we've gone from a half to a full one, number one neutral density, and we've made significant progress on that. We actually did get to light a fire here in Texas that was controlled, by the way, and we flew it, and we could see the flames really well, and it was a big step forward for us, and the fire research is going well. So right in the middle of the podcast, I was going to try to call in, but we had launched, and I was doing my piloting duties, and I just couldn't break away in time to get in on the podcast, and executed the flight and managed to land things and keep it all in one piece. So we were pretty happy with that. That was my week, all week last week.
Well, it sounds interesting, and yeah, I figured when you didn't call in, you had your hands full. No big deal, you know. You gotta pay the rent, as it were. So, but that's good. You come back here, you kind of tell us, give us some insight, and that is funny that you mention that. You know, the white screen. What's wrong here? So, you know, that's the type of tips you get here at on the SUS News podcast. So, you know, maybe hopefully you've helped some people in the future with that. Anything else in the news catch your eye, Gene?
Well, there's one little bit of news that I'd like to throw out there. You know, as you know, the book First to Deploy has been out. And I've been notified that it's going to be used as the basis for the UAS concentration for Atlanta State University, and they plan to use the book to do their U.S. operations capstone course, which I'm pretty excited about. And one of the tasks that they are going to put in their curriculum is that you have to use a small unmanned aircraft in a search and rescue scenario. So I'm pretty excited about that one. I'm going to work with those guys over there and see if I can help them out. You know, obviously we've got a few more scenarios we could go through, and we could give them a bunch of different environments to operate in and make it a little bit of a challenge. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, that sounds good. That's always a positive thing. You know, so that's good news. We should do a little story about that on the homepage, I think.
I think so.
And I like to hear stuff like that. I like success stories. Makes me feel all warm and cozy. Well, I've got some news, and it's about we landed a sponsor for the podcast, and I'm going to read this now. Today's podcast is sponsored by Hood Technology, experts in advanced EO/IR gyro stabilized four-axis imaging systems for small unmanned aircraft systems. The company offers low swap payloads integrating EO, MWIR, and lasers to provide unparalleled long-range imaging for moving platforms. I'd like everyone to visit www.hoodtech.com for more information. That's HOODTECH.com for more info. And that makes me warm and fuzzy too. Hopefully our listeners will go out there and look at that. They've got some good sensors and some other products and an interesting website. All right.
Thanks.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm just glad to welcome Hood Technologies onto the podcast.
Me too. I'm glad that we got somebody on here to help move things along. So with that, let's move into segment one. Now, as usually the case here, the guests are known to the hosts on the program, and this case is the same. I've known our guest John for a few years and have followed his progress in trying to bring a small UAS product to market. John, I know you, but could you please give the audience a little bio about yourself and how you got to where you are today?
Oh, sure, Patrick and Gene. Thanks for having me this morning. And I'll tell you that the weather here in San Diego, California is, as always, beautiful. So, Gene, I feel for you down there in Texas. I'll start here, and I think the reason that I talked to you, Patrick, and offered to come on and do a podcast with you is because I feel like there's not really a lot of progress right now in the effort to open up the national airspace and integrate these small unmanned systems from a commercial point of view. I'm talking a true commercial industry being developed, and I think that's the interest that I have and the intention around me joining you on your program. I'll actually say that presently I'm running a small company focused on bringing a lighter than air system to market, and we'll probably want to talk about that a bit later. The company's called Soft Coast, but I'll kind of go back and just let you know that I spent about 14 years in the military as a special operations member, specifically with Naval Special Warfare, or SEAL Team. And, you know, the first period of my career, I spent as a, not only as a SEAL operator, but as a communicator. And I can tell you that in that period of time, and my career actually spanned pre-9/11 as well as post-9/11, so I kind of I have a flavor for both eras, if you will, if you want to call them that. What I think is interesting here is when I was working with technology as an end user or SEAL, communications almost seemed magical to a lot of SEALs, and it was kind of like the way you ended up becoming a communicator and SEAL Team was, hey, new guy, go get that radio and figure out how to turn it on, and so that's basically what happened. It wasn't like, hey, John, has this intelligence quotient or he's a really smart guy, he knows what he's doing. It's just I happened to be standing next to the radio, and I was the newest guy on the team, so bam, there I am. So I actually am a pretty curious guy by nature, and so I started, and basically I didn't want to let anybody down. I didn't want to be that guy that didn't know how to do what I was supposed to be doing. And so when you're the guy carrying the phone, so to speak, when somebody tells you to make a phone call, you better make a phone call, and it better work, right, because everybody's looking at you at that point.
Right.
So I ended up learning about communications and understanding about theory, and then as I progressed through my career, I began to really understand shortfalls, and it wasn't like I had a magic pill in my rucksack that I could just pull out and solve everybody's problems. There were moments where the light was on me, and I literally was having to, at the time, we did HF for high-frequency communications. I'm not sure if anybody's doing that anymore. We did an old-school, a PRC 104, right, dialing up HF frequencies, looking at propagation tables and ionospheric, right, disturbances and sunspots and solar activity to figure out how to communicate long range to somebody, because access to satellite communication systems or global, commercial or military was really limited. So the point is breakdowns or problems as a communicator, right, was something that I learned and kind of was ingrained in me really early on in my career, and I always carried that with me. And I kind of got patted on the back a little bit every once in a while because I was willing to open the manual, RTFM, right, and just actually see, right, how the devices work. And then I was curious enough to start talking to the engineers and the companies that built these radio systems and ask them questions. And I remember them telling me, we've never had anybody, right, as an operator want to talk to us about anything. And I said, well,
I think I can wear your pocket protector, so we could actually communicate and get along just fine. So I don't really have any issue at all. And really, it was just because I wanted to be good at my job. Well, fast forward a few years later where, you know, 9/11 happens. And, you know, I was part of a team that went forward into Afghanistan. And one of the problems that we had in Afghanistan was communications. And I remember, like, there was a moment where I remember just, like, around me, I think, and this is me guessing, trying to figure out how many people were actually supporting my small team on the ground of about 12 guys, maybe 16 guys, in some part of Afghanistan, performing right, one of the tasks or the missions that we had been assigned. And I think there were probably 150 people, right, around us to support 16 guys on the ground. And I can remember, like, there were airplanes, big, heavy, you know, fixed-wing aircraft of all kinds of sizes and speeds that were literally circling overhead, and we were literally just sitting in one spot, right, doing something we were supposed to be doing. And I remember thinking, good grief, that's the only way I can communicate is talking to these, like, 15 people flying around in this $40 million aircraft over my head. There's got to be a simpler way because this isn't scalable. You know, I'm tip of the spear. I'm with special operations. I'm a SEAL. What about the average soldier, right? The average, and I don't mean to denigrate or anything. I mean, I hold them in the highest regard. And what about the conventional general purpose force end user? He's not going to, you know, they're just not enough to go around for everybody to get, right, 150 people supporting them on every operation they're going to be conducting. And remember, we were very early on, so we didn't have the big, you know, established force on the ground in Afghanistan yet. It was really kind of the Wild West, and we were kind of there fending for ourselves and doing, you know, doing our jobs accordingly.
Right. It was so Wild West.
Point, yeah, it was the Wild West. And so at
weren't
that
you guys
point,
riding horses?
Well, I wasn't. That was a team that came off, you know, came in earlier, and, you know, I don't comment about other people's stuff, but the point is that wasn't my group. We actually had vehicles, but they were thin-skinned vehicles. We didn't have any armor. I can remember actually, you know, taping, you know, whatever body armor we had, like taping it to our seats and taping it around us to kind of just, you know, to provide. I think it wasn't going to help us at all. It was just going to, you know, make me feel better about the, you know, driving around there. At least I could pretend that I was going to be okay if something happened.
Right. Sometimes anyway, feeling good is half of the deal right there. But this is fascinating.
False motivation is better than no motivation, Patrick. That's what I used to say.
Exactly. Well, like, you know, I mean, this is all really, this background is really fascinating. But, you know, I mean, as you came into this, you know, I could see you had this communications background and, you know, integrating new technologies. I mean, when small unmanned aircraft showed up to you, what were your first impressions?
Well, first of all, we didn't know what it was, A, and didn't know what to call it, B, and it kind of was, you know, it was looked at as, oh gosh, just another, you know, gadget we're going to have to carry around that, you know, you have to have a PhD to figure out how to operate. So we ended up, you know, the way things usually work, it's whoever is standing closest to the box basically gets tasked. And I happened to be, you know, standing near the box, and they said, hey, Sermont, you're kind of a smart guy. You kind of got, you know, the ability to turn on a radio. So why don't you figure out how to use that too? And, you know, me being curious, I basically said, sure, but let me take a step back. As I started to kind of look at this airplane, as it were, in a box, I started thinking about RC, right? So I immediately associated this small drone with an RC aircraft. It was just kind of, you try to figure out where to start when you don't know where to begin, right? And so where I started was, okay, these little small RC aircraft, this kind of looks like that too. Maybe I should learn how to fly an RC aircraft first. And so believe it or not, my initial drone quote-unquote training was actually I went and found a couple of old guys at a local RC airfield and said, hey, guys, you know, talk to me about flying an RC airplane. And so... Then I went to my chain of command and I said, hey, listen, you know, this flying this RC aircraft is a lot of work, and I'm kind of concerned about it. And they said, well, you know, try this thing over here. They say that they've removed all of that stuff. You don't have to know how to fly the airplane. You just basically throw it in the air and you're okay. And so I said, fine. And so we basically it was like cavemen looking at a fire. It's like, oh, okay, let's see what we can do with it. And believe it or not, they just gave me the equipment, and I literally was just taking it out to the RC flying field and operating it and learning how to fly it and break it and repair it. And there was no – I didn't know what an FSR was. There was no instructor on scene with me. It was just a box of stuff and me kind of out there figuring it out. And frankly, you know, in some ways, I think what I learned as a SEAL was – you know, learn to figure it out and be confident in your ability to adapt and overcome. And I just, in my mind, I decided that I was going to figure this out no matter what, and then committed and went to it, and then, you know, took a lot of time and a lot of mistakes, a lot of breaking stuff, but I did.
Well, and that's, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I kind of had the same start, but it, you know, a little bit different. And same deal, you know, you experiment, you see what you can do, you learn the system. And so, like, I guess, you know, the next was when you finally took it out in the field, you're like, okay, well, I kind of know what this thing can do. I know what the cone of view of the camera is, and I'm going to take it out in the field, and I'm going to see what I can do with it. Was it something that paid off straight away, or was it something that you had to develop the capability? Maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, so that right there is a great question, Patrick, and I'll tell you, in the beginning, I kind of chuckle when I say this because I thought it was going to be just, hey, figure out how to fly it and everything else will fall into place. But what I didn't realize was flying it wasn't the point, right? And so in the very beginning, once I figured out how to actually fly and I started looking through the camera, I started realizing how powerful it was to be able to get, you know, in real time an aerial perspective or point of view, so you can actually start monitoring and observing activity, you know, from a point of view that I've never had before. And so it was actually breathtaking and game-changing, and I can remember being so excited, and I remember bringing it back, and I was telling anybody that would listen to me and talking about it. I was dragging the boxes around. Hey, look at this. You guys got to see this. I can remember, you know, and by the way, SEALs, in the special operations community, you're in three states in general. You're either getting qualified, performing, right, your task operationally, or degrading qualifications, or resetting. And so, you know, everybody's, you know, working on chasing falls and staying qualified, so people have things to do, and I'm, like, stopping them in the compound. Hey, look at this. Take a look at this, guys. This is so great. And people will be like, Johnny, you're so excited about it. That's great. Really don't understand what you're talking about. Don't have a lot of time, but hey, man, you know, catch me later. And so I remember almost becoming a little bit of an advocate, right, for these small systems and trying to take them to anybody that would pay attention. And I do, you know, I do remember talking with one of my commanders at the time, and he basically, and I was complaining to him. I'm like, hey, sir, nobody will listen to me. Like, this is groundbreaking technology, but no, I can't get anybody's attention. He said, you know, John, maybe what we need to do is have an officer, like aviator guy, show up and help you kind of advance this, and he can actually go to the meetings and sit in these different kinds of meetings and inform people and kind of work on top-down, and you can work on bottom-up. And so I said, great. So long story short, they then staffed me with somebody who was scheduling aviation assets for the entire West Coast community. They call him an air scheduler, and so he kind of got involved. And then when he started looking at it, he started getting really excited. And so now you had two guys, right? And then as he got excited, he basically said, "Hey, John, you just need to go beg, borrow, and steal. We need to start building a cadre and start training people up, and get some money so we can get some more gear." And start making the improvements because they're not quite ready to deploy yet. But boy, there's a great capability here, a great opportunity. And so that bringing that next person on board, Patrick, was critical because that doubled frankly, that doubled our quote-unquote organization. We weren't official in any way. There was no funding line. There was no program. There was nothing in place except two guys and a little bit of what we call top cover in the military with some great leaders above us that gave us the opportunity to try, right, to build something special. And that's kind of how it started.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you know what? As you were going through that and talking about some of that, I want to give Gene an opportunity to jump in here because I had a lot of those same parallel feelings. And Gene, I know that you shared some of those. Would you like to comment on that?
I had to laugh at some of the things that that John was talking about. I mean, because you're right, John. You get that next person involved, and your force just doubles. And you've actually got somebody who will help you promote or, you know, actually spread the word so that other people can understand better what these small unmanned aircraft can give them out in the field. So that was, you were right on target. I thought that was such a good point to make, but it has been a very slow but sure kind of progression to the point where people are finally starting to understand what we really can do with these small unmanned aircraft, don't you think?
I'm sorry, Patrick. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You can go ahead, and I'll have comment after.
Okay.
Go for it.
Well, all I was going to say, Gene, was I asked one of my bosses at the time. I said, "Hey, sir, I'm honored, right? Because I think this is going to be big." And I remember telling that. You know, this is 2003-04 time frame, and I can remember him looking at me and saying, it could be big, John, if the right people are involved, right? He said it could fall apart and disappear if they're not. And he said, we need people with the intelligence, but we also need people with that energy, right, to generate interest and help people become believers, right, in this kind of technology. So, you know, the point here is you've got a lot of people involved and stakeholders in these silos. Is what I like to say. There were kind of these silos of influence, silos of interest, silos of practice, and you know, there were kind of three circles. And at the time, they were kind of loosely orbiting around each other, but they weren't really connected to really drive things forward. And I think, in some ways, it's almost like conception. It's a little bit of biology and chemistry and putting everything together, right, and physics, and then some of it is frankly just luck. It takes form and takes shape, and then you know, you have a starting point, kind of a spark and an idea in somebody's head, and then you put it in somebody else's head, and then you actually start putting things in action. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I realized looking back is because, you know, SEAL Team, Naval Special Warfare, and even the Special Operations Community at large, I can't speak of any other components because I wasn't a member of the Army or the Air Force or anybody else, but I could talk about maybe in the SEAL Team, there is an entrepreneurial kind of mentality. In other words, figure it out, get it done, accomplish the mission, take care of each other along the way, and, you know, and rinse and repeat and keep doing it. And so I think there, because of that kind of entrepreneurial mindset, and by the way, SEALs are trusted by the leadership, and so we do have autonomy, and, you know, it's not like we have to report and everybody's checking, doing head counts all the time. I mean, obviously there's good order and discipline as a military unit, but you do have some flexibility and some latitude, and I was given, as they say, lots and lots of rope, and I was told, John, run as fast as you can, as far as you can, break it, we'll buy more, do what you need to do, and if we need to pull you back, we will, but you need to go. We don't know how far we can go with this, and you need to tell us. You need to show us the way, and that was my direction, and by golly, the leadership continued to just show up and support, right, myself, and then eventually my boss that came in, and then he started to really, like, staff us, work with the vendors, work with the military the program, you know, manager types, generating requirements, current requirements from current operations, and then feeding those into the loop. And, you know, there was the point where we as SEALs and our community were essentially kind of driving a lot of the early small unmanned systems developmental efforts. in the form of articulating requirements, articulating what works, what doesn't work, with the different vendors. And there was a really great feedback loop where we could immediately talk to the vendor. They could show us what they're working on. We could take it out and use it, and then we could say whether it's working or not working or things that might need to be changed. And, you know, I learned later on that, you know, we weren't the only people doing that, right? But because there's these different silos at the time, you know, the Army and some folks out at Natick were working on some things, some folks on the East Coast were working on some things, and eventually, right, parochial interests notwithstanding and kind of put aside, there's still a little bit of that. Maybe there always will be because, you know, we feel very strongly about our quote-unquote families. But eventually we kind of put those things aside and came together after a heck of a lot of work and a lot of healthy debate. You know, they were controversial. The whole idea of the small unmanned system was controversial in the beginning. Initially it wasn't taken seriously. And then at some point it began to be taken seriously, and then it kind of became controversial. And the birth of small unmanned systems in the military is a fascinating story, and I do think at some point in time, you know, somebody needs to do what they can to collect all of those true stories and not polished, you know, not cleaned up or filtered. I mean, just the individual effort across the military area of practice. There were people that were putting their careers on the line, putting their reputations at stake because they believed in this technology, and boy, I'm glad they did. And it's refreshing for me to kind of go back and think about that because there was an energy, an interest, an optimism, and a belief, right, in that this would benefit the end user on the ground. And I believe, you know, history will show us that it does and will continue to. And the focus, you know, my focus was small systems. I'm not an expert or a practitioner with large systems. And when I say a large system, anything kind of above the 15 to 20-pound range, that's not my bag because I'm focused on guys and girls, right, that are carrying stuff around in a box or a bag, right, and they're out kind of by themselves, and they're what I would consider to be a tactical kind of user, and they need the lightest weight, smallest stuff. And for me, I think that is still really important for that end user, but I actually think because of the small size, that actually has a great potential and prospect and promise for the commercial market here in the United States. I mean, I'm not advocating for a Volkswagen-sized thing to be flying around over neighborhoods, right, without any kind of, you know, oversight or flight planning, et cetera, but I do think that there are small technologies. I think it's almost like an overkill to eliminate any possible risk with anything. Therefore, the small systems are guilty by association. And I kind of think that's misguided. It may be well-meaning, but I definitely think it's caused all kinds of gnashing of teeth, as it will.
Yeah. Now, a lot of those points you made, I mean, I'm sitting here nodding the head, and I know Gene's nodding the head, and there are a lot of parallels between the commercial world and the military world. It's kind of funny you say that. It's part of my advocacy work back, I think it was 2004 or 5, talking to a government guy from DOD and saying, hey, you know, same thing. This technology, this small unmanned aircraft, has a lot of potential at the squad level or for people on the ground. And you know, the guy disagreeing with me. Know what they need.
Well, Patrick, yeah. Let me qualify that. So, in some ways, he was right, and in some ways, you were right. So both. See, here's the thing. There were both positions were right because when it was so new that guys were still trying to figure out how to use it. Now, let me explain to you. As a SEAL, you have to be very careful about what kind of tools you're even going to expend energy to learn to use, right? Your primary tasks are to shoot, move, and communicate. If you've got something else that you need to be worrying about, that means that you're going to have to switch context. And you're going to have to add an additional task, which is actually going to degrade your ability to perform the three primary tasks that you have, right? Mm-hmm. That's a long that's a long way of saying there were a lot of guys looking at this box of stuff and listening to me talk about how great it was, telling me, that's great, John. So now I got to take a guy off a gun so they can actually fly the remote control airplane around? Are you kidding me? And so there was a huge debate inside the organization. And frankly, I understood both sides of it. And so, you know, my position was, hey, this is worth figuring out, right, how to integrate and incorporate into our organization. And, you know, kind of where we started was this small stuff, and then, you know, small things at the time were limited, right, in their range, in their performance, in their survivability, and actually the payload capability. And what I mean by that, when you're talking about activity-based information gathering, you know, you need a certain level of fidelity. You need to be able to see, right, to a certain extent. And, you know, specifics are not important in this case. And I think that, you know, you end up having to work with what you can fly around in that small form factor. And so that means that sometimes you have to fly lower, right? Or you're limited by the range of the radio or something, and so you got to fly lower, and now you're flying lower over an area, and you're making some noise, and then people are like, wait a minute, that's not going to work either. So what do you do? And so that then goes back into the loop, right? So you then tell the vendor, here's where we're at, this is the feedback that we're getting, and you know they continue to work on things, and then we also one of our responsibilities was to develop, I think the kind of one generation would call them SOPs, standard operating procedures, and then another generation or era would call them TTPs, or techniques, tactics, and procedures. And it's very important to understand that, you know, MFT 11, Special Operations Command, and Naval Special Warfare, who's underneath the Special Operations Command, is funded through MFT 11 dollars. And, you know, we protect, as an organization, we protect our techniques, tactics, and procedures. I'm not going to comment about what's happening in the media. That's frankly none of my business, and I'm not my purview. But what I will say is it's very bad optics and very dangerous for us to publicly talk about our, you know, specific tactics and procedures around anything, and especially, you know, how we might employ technology.
Agreed.
Right. Yeah, we agree with that one, too.
And I'll just say that it's kind of like, you know, a professional football team telegraphing a play before they actually call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're going to get their clock cleaned, right, if they do that. And nobody complains about Bill Belichick. How come he's not telling the world his play, right? Why do people feel like they need this complete transparency with, you know, our special operations professionals and what they're doing? So I think there's a bit of naivety. I think there's a little bit of a kind of a fetishization of the military, and, you know, SEALs kind of seem to be the trendy topic of the day, and that will pass, I hope, and we'll kind of go back to doing what we need to be doing and quietly being the professionals that we are, have been, are, and always will be. So the point here is there's a reason why that person disagreed with you, Patrick, and he may have not been able to get into all the details, and then there's a reason why, you know, you kind of said, wait a minute, and didn't get quite into all these details with him. And so over time, an enormous amount of effort, and what's really important is there was a point where it became less about technology and more about people and organizations and structure and integration. And that's a turning point. It's a monumental turning point because people can start to still think, well, I got to build a technology. I got to perfect the technology. If I could just make it do this, if I could just make it do that. And they completely forget, right, about the human being, right? And they think it's just about the drone or the robot or the widget. And it really took some discipline and courage and a heck of a lot of effort for leaders inside of the military and even leaders in industry, folks that are program managers and officers for the government itself, to actually come together and really kind of walk through lessons learned and kind of own shortfalls. And what really kept showing up was, guys, the technology is on this ridiculous pace. It's just getting better and better and better. So from a technology perspective, it makes sense for us to continue to invest. But by golly, we don't just want to invest in the technology. We need the capability. So we've got to really get clear on how we can effectively utilize these kinds of technologies. And then there were questions about, is it the right size? Do we need more capability? What might that capability look like? And so there's been an enormous amount of thought that's gone into that. It didn't just magically appear. It didn't just magically get fielded. And it doesn't magically work.
Right. But I will say, one of the perspectives that I brought with that to that conversation, and some of the points you hit on about size and everything else, and I think Gene would probably agree possibly with me, I think that even at those times, the technology that was available and the price points that these systems were being sold for, I had this idea then of a, semi-disposable, man-portable system where, if you crashed it, big deal, you pull another one out of the box, you just kept throwing these things in the air, and a price point to be more at $15,000 or $50,000 for a system instead of $250,000 or $500,000 for a system, and, bring the capabilities along with that that are available from, say, the commercial market or now what people would call COTS. Gene, agree, disagree?
Well, to a point. I mean, to me, back in my day, of course, I'm going to date myself when I start talking about Law's rockets, but, a Law's rocket was $6,000. One shot, you threw away the tube, and the enemy, ended up using them and recharging them. But, I mean, it was still $6,000. You and I have discussed the $10,000 UA for the longest time, and I think we're seeing it now. And I think we're going to get to that point. And John, I'm sure that you've probably seen some of these smaller semi-disposable UAs that are coming out that are going to fit in that category.
Yep. Well, and so, Patrick, a good point, Gene. Patrick, the other point here is there was an earnest effort afoot to actually work through that. And actually, the initial concept was, let's take a X-diameter PVC piece of PVC tubing, and then let's build a low-cost, like, COTS UAF around that and see what we can come up with. And it was tough because the technology, some of the components just weren't ready. I mean, the data links were some of the biggest problems with these early small unmanned systems, and you'd have things just literally fly away. You'd be flying, just disappear. It's like, what? Where did it go? And then we had to start putting Falcon trackers on them, just because of that reason. And so, processor speed and power and energy density for batteries and all of the things that are involved in making these small systems work really, really well, because let's face it, there's a zero defect, essentially, requirement for that military customer. Now, it's impossible to build anything with zero defects. Everything is going to have some limitation at some extent, but there still is a really tall mountain to climb, right, when you're talking about putting these kinds of technologies into the field. And what I'll also say is, at that time, keep in mind, what the era that I'm talking to you guys about was actually before the iPhone, okay? Mm-hmm. So some of the listeners need to understand that I'm talking to you before there was an iPhone, right? Before there was a real understanding of what lightweight mobile computing could actually mean. It was still kind of everybody had their own thing, and you're still kind of trying to figure it out. Most of the time it was based around a BlackBerry.
Right.
It was kind of a closed system.
But it's funny you say that about the iPhone, because I was the first guy to catch an aerial photograph with an iPhone. We put one on a plane, flew it around, and grabbed that photo, and that story went around the world. So, I mean, I was there for that. I have to say, again, and I'm not trying to dig my heels in, but I will say, and that's going to kind of lead into the next couple of segments that we're going to have to go into, because it's a fascinating conversation. But I believe, John, from what I've seen, too, from coming from the commercial side, working for the Navy, working for the Army, I think what's missing is the competition of the marketplace. And I think if the FBO process, or let's say the military purchasing process, was a little bit, let's say, more of a level playing field, innovation would have happened faster with this technology. And, you know, that's kind of a closed loop, that FBO process.
Well, Patrick, that's a good point. You know, I think the step back, you know, it's a fundamental biological truth that, you know, in our brain stems as people, we're wired to, respond to incentives. People will respond when they have an incentive to respond. Otherwise, they'll conserve energy and they won't. Mm-hmm. And the point is, in that period of time, right, we weren't concerned about budget. Now, there was still a very diligent effort to make sure that every dollar of taxpayers' money was stewarded correctly. But mm-hmm. it really was, we were given permission, right, to run long, to try things, to break stuff, and they would, you know, and our organization would support us on that, and they would buy more. So we weren't necessarily concerned about the low cost. We wanted the best possible capability. And I think the point was that was an incentive, right, economically for the military technology providers in the industry to actually respond. And I think that, you know, they base their, you know, financials and their projections, you know, so they can show that they can be profitable and sustainable and have predictable revenues. Well, when you talk about the commercial marketplace, it is wildly unpredictable, and there's so much uncertainty that, you know, really all you can do is hope, right, that these existing military technology providers, I think they're hoping for a similar kind of business model, right, that they were working with the military, but the military budgets are shrinking, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty right now in the economic, state or health for the United States in present and looking forward. So there's a heck of a lot of fear. And I think there's, on the one hand, I think there's a real desire to actually bring this industry to life and open up, the technology and the needs and the applications for lots of different commercial users. And I lump public safety and first responders into that commercial category. But
sure.
I think on the one hand, but I think on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of fear, right, to say, well, if these things aren't profitable to produce, you know, what are we going to do?
Well, you know, we could argue that, and I definitely, again, you know, coming from the commercial world and working in the military side of things, the amount of money that is let's say spent on these more legacy vendors or whatever else, you could set up a pretty good shop with a lot of people and stay in business for a long time. But I don't, you know, we're going to have to save some of that for another time, because we're really running long, and I wanted to get into a couple other segments I wanted to talk about, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about these subjects. But I know, you know, you've been working for a while on your own projects since being out of the military. And when I was at the Unmanned Systems North America here in Las Vegas, I saw your Mako flying in the Lockheed Martin booth. And, I felt good. I like to see people succeed. I like to see when something good happens to people. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that happened. And, you're one of the guys that was a little bit successful in moving your product forward. So maybe you could tell us about that.
Well, thank you, Patrick. I really appreciate that. And, first of all, you know, I'm building what I call a hybrid air system, and
mm-hmm.
It's a lighter than air system. It's a helium-filled tethered aerostat. It's a rucksack portable or a man portable tethered aerostatic system. And really, the purpose for this platform is something that you can carry in a box or a ruck, and be able to elevate lightweight payloads. You know, in the 2 to 4 pound category, and you know, for the purposes of establishing communications, right, in a time of need or disaster, you can fly lightweight ISR or, you know, optical or electro-optical imaging systems, whether they're day or night, and then be able to provide that live video down to the ground. Now, I'm not building a tethered aerostat because I don't know how to build anything else. Mm-hmm. I'm building it because I see a blatant need for it, a gap right now in the marketplace. And I am working with a military customer to perfect a variant for them to actually take into the field and evaluate here in the spring, hopefully. And you know, so far, so good. But I think in the commercial application is really, you know, where I see the need and the opportunity. I'm a realist here. I'm optimistic about many, many things, Patrick, but however, I'm a pragmatist when it comes to the Federal Aviation Administration. And I know that lots and lots and lots of people are hopeful for, you know, kind of an unlocking to occur, the quickening, right, as Art Bell would say, around integrating small unmanned systems in the national airspace system. I'm sure, right, that people are hopeful, were hopeful that that would happen in 2012, not happening. I'm sure that there are still people that are holding out hope for 2013. There will be some movement there, but it's going to be glacial, right, and it's going to be primarily for first responders, public safety, with these emergency COA kind of things, with the smattering of access around kind of controlled environments, you know, in the United States, and that's already happening on the border and other parts. But, you know, that larger opening or quickening of the marketplace, you know, I'm frankly not particularly optimistic about it, and so that's why I decided to build this product. Product, it actually flies on a tether, right? And mm-hmm. it's therefore it's considered to be a stationary, a tethered or moored balloon, and so it falls into a different category. It's not a heavier than air system that's flying around, you know, wherever it wants to go or wherever the operator sends it. So, you know, in some ways, I kind of have put my money where my mouth is, if you will, in that this system is my acknowledgement of the importance of what I call low altitude access for lightweight payloads and technologies, but my acceptance, right, that there's still going to be a serious set of hurdles and obstacles that we're faced with and confronted with before the market really unlocks. And what I was leading into earlier is, frankly, this is the same situation that we're dealing with in trying to unlock the commercial space right now is something that I recognize occurred in the military. And what it is you need to be able to have the right kind of energy. You need to be able to have the right kind of imagination. You need to be able to have the right kind of advocacy to drive the vision forward and people will eventually catch it. You know, sometimes just saying the same thing over and over and over is actually what your job is to do. And right. But you have to make sure that what you're saying is credible and is large enough, right, and inclusive enough to incentivize enough people to get involved and help make the changes that need to be made or push the effort forward. That's what right. I think we need. There's a point right now where the military technology, you know, providers and the folks that were doing this, kind of bringing this to life in the military, they did a great job, right? But I don't think it necessarily just overlays on the domestic space here in the United States. Like putting a key in a lock and being able to unlock. Well, this key works for the military, so we'll just use this key for the domestic market in the U.S. I think that's short-sighted, and I don't think it's big enough. Now, it might be terrifying, right, to think that, well, wait a minute, what, we're going to do, it's going to be bigger? Oh, my gosh, I don't know if we can handle this. But I think, you know, unlocking the national airspace for small unmanned systems is akin to putting a man on the moon. Now, some might go, what's this guy talking about? I think that the industry is representative and is big enough, right, as a byproduct of being able to truly integrate small unmanned systems into the national airspace that it really will create jobs and technologies and benefits in ways we can't even imagine yet, just like the Apollo space program.
I concur with
that. And, you know, the saddest part of this, though, Patrick, is we had a president that basically put us on notice and charged us that in a certain period of time we're going to do this, and had that kind of leadership and vision. And I'm not knocking any particular political administration at all. But what I'm trying to say is the vision for this needs to be much bigger because the impact is much bigger. And instead of being afraid of it and shying away from it or trying to control it, it must become transparent, and we should actually look at it as an opportunity instead of a threat.
Well, I you know what, you're preaching to the choir over here, because I've said for a long time, you know, we need to make the effort, the integration effort, let's say, more inclusive, more daylight, public process. And, you know, I get pushback everywhere. I get pushback from the FAA. I get pushback from, let's say, allies or whatever. People are afraid of, you know, rattling the cage or, you know, upsetting the apple cart. Personally, I don't really care, man. You know, you were talking about integration in 2012, 2013, yada, yada. Me and Gene were back there in 2007 saying, hey, man, 60, 90 days, 6 months, we're going to be in the air. And, never materialized.
If Patrick, if you and I would have talked, then I would have told you were crazy. I would have said, there is no way.
You wouldn't have been the first one.
I would have told you based on my own experience and knowledge. And, you know, I have one of my roles eventually in Naval Special Warfare and SEAL team, you know, was as an officer, assistant officer in charge of the UAS program for Naval Special Warfare. And then I actually became kind of the airspace coordinator. So my job, you know, at some point it was, hey, John, the Wild West days are over. You can't just take this thing out and fly it anywhere. You have to put together curriculum, and now you have to have some processes. Go figure out how to actually fly this thing legally. And so that set me off on a whole other path. And so I have a staff. I've been responsible for putting COAs in place as a military member, and I've also actually successfully put COAs in place as a civilian. So I've got the firsthand experience with those processes. And it is possible. It's not impossible. It's happening all over the place, but it takes time, and it's not scalable. It's not something that creates a healthy, vibrant industry. It creates a small niche, right, that has all kinds of issues and is problematic for people trying to enter the niche. The other point that I want to make with you, Patrick, is that I listen to you when I talk, and you'll kind of counter, and I can hear it in your voice, man. I feel for you. It sounds like you're frustrated, you're fed up, you're burnt out, you're tired, and I guarantee there are people out there, small business owners, inventors, even investors and entrepreneurs, that are scratching their heads going, golly, this is not going the way we thought it was going to go. And all I can say to you guys is, now is not the time. Right, to, you know, there's an emotional strength that has got to be, it's got to be visible. It's got to happen. People have to have the courage to keep moving. And what I would say right now is not the time for people to entrench themselves, to take these positions and start poking people in the eye. I think there needs to be a clearing, if you will. I think I've got some issues with some of the folks, right, and some of these trade associations that have been espousing happy talk, right, for the past couple of years, and I like these people. I actually respect them, and I appreciate what they're doing. But I do think that it's got to a point where it's kind of a status quo. Go along. This old process will be just laid over this new process, and I completely disagree. And I think that, you know, there needs to be a clearing with those small business owners and those investors in those small businesses and those entrepreneurs and those innovators who are kind of going, what happened? I thought this was gonna work, and I don't know what to do, and I'm gonna go find work, and this and that and the other. And I think there needs to be a resetting. There needs to be a rebalancing in the establishing the vision, establishing the mandate, and I think we need to basically agree, right, that, you know, there's some things that everybody's learned here along the way, and we're going to recommit, and we're going to make the vision bigger, and we're going to decide that we are determined to make this work and make it happen.
Well, And you're, you know, Brother John, you're preaching to the choir over here. I'm all in on that. But I what I see in the airspace integration effort, and I've seen it for a while, and it makes me popular with lots of folks here, but what I'm seeing is pretty typical, let's say, lawmaking at the federal level, where the consultants are in there. And, you know, it reminds me of a saying about, you know, a good parasite doesn't kill the host, okay? And you got some people there. We've moved into a 10-year plus effort where people are riding this as a career. You just keep pushing the peanut along. We're off ramping into private sector jobs. Where, you know, consulting, or we're making this something. Hey, you know, give me some more money. I can do this. But people are afraid to really address the issues because the issues aren't that big. I mean,
let me just make a comment. There's a bias orientation right now that, frankly, is not beneficial or healthy for the small and man systems space. And that bias right now, it's an institutional bias, and I'm frankly not sure how it happened. But I think I can remember back when we started kind of dealing with these small drones when I was in SEAL team. You know, it was like, hey, John's an operator. He's excited about it. He's using it. But we need to actually bring an aviator in to help him because this thing's flying around, right? And I think that's kind of what happened along the way. It's like, hey, this is a small thing flying around. We've got to get the aviation community involved. And I'm not saying they don't need to be involved, but I'm not sure they need that the FAA has to have proponency on something that's 4.4 pounds or smaller. I don't agree with that. And I think that institutional bias, right, that's kind of being, you know, created here in the commercial market space is putting the same kind of requirements and, frankly, risk, zero tolerance for any kind of risk requirements on top of a small unmanned system that, let's face it, Patrick, there is no small unmanned system that it can even meet the airworthiness certification requirements. I'm not even sure if any large unmanned system has actually met them. All of them have been waived.
No. And, you know, the other thing I keep saying, it was a good point someone else had made, you know, is certified aircraft don't crash, you know. You know, we could go round and round on this, but I will say, you know, that, you know, even the current arc that's going on, there's no small business representation. The FAA doesn't take it serious. They listen to the same vendors. It's, you know, oh, look, let's get these same vendors in here to tell us what we need to do, you know. The game is rigged. It is really rigged. And, you know, until we have some accountability and small business get in there, you know, it's going to be an issue because you have banned aviation people. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that I think this latest basically suspension by the FAA of the six site selection process for the mass integration effort, I personally believe that, you know, you can't pretty this one up. Like, you're going to have to put lipstick on this pig. And I think there's a lot of people that are saying, hey, the happy talk ain't working anymore, folks. We got to have a family meeting, a come to Jesus meeting, as one of my old platoon chiefs used to say, and get clear on this and then figure out what to do forward. Because I do think that there's going to be – I think there's small unmanned systems segment, right, in a space, and I think they're saying, you know, they're probably asking the question, why are we being lumped into the rest of this mess, right? There might need to be a business as usual process for the large systems, but why are we getting basically lumped into this and being prevented from entering a marketplace? And I do think there's going to be an accounting that's going to have to be had. I think there are questions that have to be asked. Now, whether or not those questions come to light, whether those issues are brought to light or just covered up or hidden away or tucked away quietly, that's a whole other question. And really, that's going to hinge on not technology. That's going to hinge on people and courage and willingness. I personally, my belief, Patrick, is there shouldn't be six sites hidden in secrecy of where the heck they are. I don't know where they are.
Right.
You know, where are these six sites, and why is the process being held in secrecy? I think it needs to be a fully transparent process. And why six? Why not 50? Why shouldn't every state have its own site. And if you don't have enough staff at the FAA, then the FAA is not the right organization.
Well, and I agree with a lot of that. Look, we got 15 seconds left. This was a good conversation. We'll have to have you back next year. I want to thank the podcast episode sponsor, Hood Technology, the makers of the only launcher I use for the Cracker Barrel. You can check that picture out at our homepage. Anyway, hoodtech.com. Check them out. Thanks, John. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
And we'll see everyone next week.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.